Secret societies have fundamentally shaped America's cultural and political landscapes in ways that are expected but never explicit. The bonds made through the most elite of secret societies have won members Pulitzer Prizes, governorships, and even presidencies. At the apex of these institutions stands Yale University and its rumored 26 secret societies. Tracing stories that have intrigued and enthralled for centuries, alluring the attention of such luminaries as Hemingway, Faulkner, and Fitzgerald, David Alan Richards has written the book Skulls and Keys, The Hidden History of Yale's Secret Societies. It traces the histories of these societies as they set the foundation for America's future secret clubs and help define the modern age of politics. David Alan Richards is an alum of Yale, a Bonesman himself, and we welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on, Joe.
I have to tell you, when this book arrived in Galley a few months ago, I was so excited to see it, and quite frankly, its enormity, because I just love diving into it. And it's such a fascinating, amazing story. Give us a sense of, first of all, what drew you to it, but then also when you realized, and perhaps this came very quickly, but when you realized that this was such an immersive and large tale to tell.
You're right. There's two strands there. There's the interest that people have in what I like to call the oogie boogie of the system, the notion that it's secret, the notion that it may be conspiratorial, the notion that it's somehow produced presidents and CIA directors, and so the outside world tends to think in terms that are out of date and yet powerful in the media. And the last book about it, a bit of a gossipy book, came out in 2002 based on the fact that George W. Bush, the Yale class of 68, the year behind me, and John Kerry of the Yale class of 66, year ahead of me, were both in an organization, a club with only 15 members every year in the senior class of Yale College, the organization, of course, called Skull and Bones, were running against each other for leader of the free world. It had happened a bit before in the city where I work, New York City, back in 1965, when the three mayoral candidates, John Lindsay and Robert Wagner and Bill Buckley Jr., were all also members of senior societies at Yale. And so people get excited about that part and the notion of windowless buildings where they meet privately and no one knows what goes on. And that fascinating part and the legends, the notion that the nuclear codes are in Skull and Bones' tomb and Wolf's Head has the biggest water bill in Connecticut because of its swimming pool, and Hitler's silverware is in Wolf's Head. Those are the three oldest societies. People kind of eat that stuff up, but at the same time, because they were small and exclusive, and of course, back in the day when Yale was white males, they reflected that demographic virtually exclusively. People saw them as privileged. But when I got into it, and when I tried to answer the basic questions of why were they secret? Why did they even start at all? Why did they last? And why did they make a difference? I got a much deeper story that goes deeply into the roots of self-education in the 19th century, the boys trying to teach themselves something in these secret groups where they could debate topics like politics and religion, which they couldn't talk about outside. And that led to there being three U.S. presidents, six secretaries of state, three secretaries of the Treasury, including President Trump's right now, men who went into public life because they'd trained themselves in these private debating clubs. And they persisted. They persisted for 150 years. And they became a machine for taking in, as Yale expanded, Americans who weren't original Yalies, Jews, blacks, Catholics, LGBT folks. And the boys, the seniors picking the juniors each year, were small d democratic and brought these people into these groups and into the American establishment 50 years before the same groups were running Yale, let alone the United States. And so ultimately I thought it was a good story, a surprising story.
I want to get to that progressive side to these societies in a moment. Let's just begin with a number. So the rumor is 26 secret societies. Do we know how many there actually are?
There are seven which have what are called tombs, the windowless buildings. Skull and Bones' tomb is the oldest fraternity house in the United States. And those are called above grounds. And then it turns out nowadays there are somewhere between 40 and 45 undergrounds, because that's how many of them sign the ad in the college newspaper saying they will abide by the Connecticut anti-hazing statutes. Mm. They are not public. Their names and their members aren't even known, the names of the older societies that gets out. So they're extremely popular these days. More than half of the seniors in Yale College are members. And that is astounding to me, but I think there's a reason for that, which we can talk about as the society's morphed from engines for leadership and rewarding leadership to engines for diversity and introducing the kids to one another and making them learn to trust one another, even though they were very different backgrounds.
So we should note, you were a Bonesman yourself.
Not something I emphasize in the book. It's not found in the book. That happens to be true. It gave me access to materials kept in scrapbooks by the boys for hundreds of years that made it easier for me to do the research.
So do you get in trouble for that or no?
No. I made an agreement with the corporate parents. All of the properties, all of the societies that own property, of course, are corporations, and the alumni run them. The alumni do interfere. They stopped the three oldest societies from tapping women for 30 years. But I made an agreement that I was going to take this project on. No one had ever done it. I thought I could do it. Bones had never had an official history. The other six had had private official histories. I could use what they printed and could believe it, I thought, since it was official. But that I would print nothing that I couldn't footnote. That as a historian trained in two different universities, where my degrees came from, that I would tell what I felt to be the truth, even though these societies were very private. And because they had stolen things from one another over the years, and interviews with divorced wives, and letters from proud sons and daughters to mothers saying they'd been elected, that stuff was all there, and it turned into a pretty long story, as you rightly pointed out.
So back to that progressive side, you write in the book that we really start to see this, and not surprisingly, but we really start to see this change and the role of the societies start to change in the 1960s. Is that safe to say?
That's absolutely correct. The public high school boys, public high schoolers did not outnumber the prep school boys until my freshman year, 1963. And there had never been very many blacks at Yale. Yale, like Harvard and other Ivy League schools, had a silent but effective Jewish quota. And it wasn't until Kingman Brewster, the president of Yale of my time, came in and saying that he was not about to preside over a finishing school on the North Shore of Long Island. And for the first time, Yale began to seriously go out to the great scientific high schools in New York and across the country, and of course now around the world, and we now have a situation where only one quarter of the Yale student body are the white males that were virtually all of the student body back in my time. Women came in 1969, and the societies, because they rewarded leadership in campus organizations, brought these various demographics who were not yet prominent, although numerous in American life or in the Ivy League, into the societies and brought them into the American establishment. And they served a purpose there, which most people simply don't recognize.
David Alan Richards is the author of the book Skulls and Keys, The Hidden History of Yale's Secret Societies. Was there a self-correction then within that time when these new people and new blood, if you will, came into the organizations, that there was a shift and a change?
Absolutely. because they used to do what was called line tapping. If you were the captain of the football team, if you were the chairman of the Yale Daily News, like Joe Lieberman, you were automatically, almost automatically, offered membership. If you were an unpleasant human being, that didn't always happen. But if you'd proved yourself, like in the most famous American college novel, Stover at Yale of 1912, something so famous that the Harvard writers of The Simpsons have made C. Montgomery Burns the retroactive roommate and a member of Skull and Bones. They like to poke fun at us. But the first football captain, first black football captain, a veteran like George H.W. Bush coming back after World War II, was tapped, as we say, hit on the shoulder at Election Day by both Skull and Bones and Skrull and Key, but he had already pledged membership into another society called Brazilius, and he honored that pledge. But it was big news in the sports writers of the Boston and New York papers. Was Bones, was Keyes going to honor its mandate of electing leaders when they had this opportunity? Would they fail publicly to elect this man? And they did. There wasn't another black football captain at Yale until 1974, and he was tapped for Bones. But this also happened with Jews, Catholics, the great Boston Celtic player, Lavelli, 47, and eventually Henry Gates, the PBS professor,
yep.
Kurt Schmoke, the mayor of Baltimore, now the president of Hampton. If you were a leader on campus, that happened, and it happened extraordinarily back in the day when the boys were trying to teach themselves speech, when Southerners were only 5% of the students at Yale, as they were before the Civil War. Yale was deemed to be the Athens of the North. The Southerners stopped coming to Yale after the Civil War. But at that time, the senior societies tapped twice as many Southerners, 10% of their membership, as their 20% of their membership, than the 10% in the class. Yale had 6 Confederate generals in the Civil War. 5 of the 6 were members of the senior societies when they were undergraduates. Fast forward 150 years later, when there are 4.5% African and African-American blacks in Yale College, and the senior societies, the 6 above grounds, are tapping 10%. By this time, diversity had become the mantra, because we'd gone from debates to giving autobiographies. Once a week, each of the 15 members would spend time telling his new mates within the circle of trust what his life was like, what had gone wrong, what had gone right. And that's what's popular today, and that's why I think the undergrounds have proliferated, because nowhere in Yale College, as back in 1832, they didn't teach extemporaneous speech. Today, they don't teach intimacy. Yale is not Michigan or one of the larger colleges, land-grant colleges, but it's still a big place. And what the students have discovered, the undergraduates, you only get in your senior year. That's one reason why none of the secrets have leaked from the underclass, because they don't get in until the beginning of their senior year. But people now understand that this is an extraordinary emotional experience. And I think that's why it's valued now, and some of these life histories that are delivered on the Thursday or the Sunday night meetings go upwards of 6 hours now, I'm told, with PowerPoints. But people find this enormously engaging. And you may not like everybody you're with, but in the same sort of theory as the Rhodes Scholars, bring the leaders together, let them understand one another, let them have intense conversations about what they care for and don't like, about things and about the world and about each other. And this is an emotionally engaging experience. At least it seems to work for most people.
Earlier in our conversation, we were talking about the proliferation, and you mentioned because many groups have signed on to this anti-hazing rules. How big a problem was hazing within the secret societies at Yale?
Not at all. We're now in a situation where fraternities, even at Yale, have hazed, but there's never been that kind of a problem. The hazing at fraternities generally, and there aren't that many at Yale, comes out of their membership being public, that the contest for that membership pledging and that sort of thing isn't public at Yale. The selections are secret until the very day of the election, and then the new members, the initiates, are taken in, and people don't know what goes on inside, but nobody comes out injured, nobody dies. That's never happened. They've never had that kind of a problem, and they certainly have never had what's now the problem up at Harvard with the Harvard equivalent of the Yale secret societies, which are called final clubs, which have had alleged sexual assaults because they're all male. Only one of them has ever had a woman member, and they have parties, and things apparently have happened, and the Harvard administration is now trying to drive them out of Harvard life. They will not permit you to apply for a Rhodes Scholarship or a Marshall or have other benefits if you're even a member. So we may be seeing the end there. The Yale secret societies took women in the first year they were at Yale. So we've never had that kind of a sexual problem that has occurred, and we never had a hazing problem, happily. And unlike the famous Cambridge student society, the Apostles, we've never had traitors like Anthony Blunt and Guy Burgess. They have a pretty good record.
So the one thing that you have to, and you do answer this in the book, but I'm curious as to how you'll answer this question through our conversation, and that is, as you mentioned, meetings that go 6 hours and PowerPoints. So in our mind, for those of us on the outside, there is that mystery. We hear of the conspiracies, we hear of the blood oaths and all of that, which is a lot more exciting, perhaps, than it actually is on the inside.
You're right. It's much more fun. Back in my day, if someone spoke to you and mentioned the name of your society, you got up and walked out on the grounds that no one should even discuss it because it's not something you wish to discuss. People are silent still today when they walk by the tombs. The societies generally have a rule that not more than three members together should be together outside so that their presence and their exclusivity is not offensive. And so all these legends are kind of fun. Without saying whether they're true or not, I reprint a lot of them. And there have been articles written about them by non-members with titles like The Elks Among Us, the notion that these are like the Shriners or something, people right. In fezes showing up. It's deeper than that. It's more emotional than that. People don't usually quit. They do leave, and it happens occasionally because the emotional intensity is sometimes not comfortable. But it's basically, at least in the above grounds, they have beautiful, large buildings. They have catered dinners there twice a week. And then they have these official meetings on Thursday nights and Sunday nights. It does take a chunk of your social life out. But you're in with folks that were deemed by the class ahead of you to be either leaders or compatible with you or to have the diversity they think produces a balanced club life. It's enormously interesting. Famous people like Bush and Kerry and Joe Lieberman and Sergeant Shriver and Anderson Cooper and Jodie Foster are products of these societies. And you think as an undergraduate, must be something to it. It's a little hard to explain. At the beginning of my book, it's I quote someone saying who was in my society saying he's just written an article about the Catholic Church, but he can't tell you about the mystery of the faith. I think that's still true. My argument is that this turned out to be important, the training that they gave and give for Yale history and American history in producing leaders. The Rhodes Scholars between 1902 and 1977, when women came in, produced one American president, one Secretary of State, one Secretary of Defense. Yale produced two Chief Justices, two Presidents of the United States, two heads of the CIA, six Secretaries of State, three Secretaries of the Treasury. And they were a machine for leadership, but clearly also for teaching people how to get along with one another.
So just looking at this struck me as I was reading the book, but you know, just looking at the cover of the book and of the building for Skull and Bones, that whole idea of mystery and conspiracy and what's going on behind those doors, that it seems that those inside don't do a lot to try to they help perpetuate that myth, right? I mean, it doesn't seem like they're outwardly
absolutely
doing...
No, they think it's good fun.
Yeah,
they think it's good fun. The notion that your badge should never leave your person. You put it in your mouth in the shower. You put it on your sock if you're with your girlfriend. You know, these are kind of fun facts. And they were true in my day. I can't tell you now. I'm 50 years out. But one must remember, having read it, that I devote a chapter to it, that secret societies were a very big deal in the United States for adults and young people. Fraternities were known as secret societies.
Right.
And they built windowless buildings. And so only later did fraternities become larger and more boisterous, but Delta Kappa Epsilon and both Bushes were the presidents of Deke when they were undergraduates, as well as being in Bones. Their first fraternity house at Yale in 1844 didn't have any windows. All fraternities were secret societies. That changed, but at Yale, it went a slightly different direction. They stayed private. They didn't take public positions. They still don't. They enjoy each other's company. They have alumni who've maintained these buildings over the years and whom the undergraduates are interested to hear come back to campus and speak to them in private. So the system perpetuates itself. But since 1970, it's been a lot less public. The New York Times started publishing the names of those elected in 1886. But after 1970, when elitism went out of favor, all of the societies became much less visible, other than the tombs on the campus, and no longer does the yearbook print the names and this sort of thing. So the offensive bits have been toned down considerably since the 19th century, when some people wouldn't send their sons to Yale because they were afraid they wouldn't be tapped 4 years later. And it was front page news when a Secretary of State's son didn't get in, or a cousin of William Howard Taft didn't get in. That poppycock, which it was called on campuses, has disappeared. But their prestige still continues, and people still like to poke at it. When Bush and Kerry were both running for president and on Meet the Press, Tim Russert asked each of them to talk about Skull and Bones, and they both refused.
Yeah.
We like to keep the private part private, but I think there's interest in the public part, and to me there were deep historical things which said well of the students in a time when Yale is convulsed over renaming Calhoun College because of his support of slavery, and other institutions across the country are similarly troubled. The notion that there were student groups not run by the faculty, not chosen by the faculty, who turned around and brought in blacks and Jews and gays, not because they were blacks and Jews and gays, but because they wanted their company and because they were honoring their achievements as fellow students, is an encouraging story. And I'm hoping that that side of that story will be appreciated.
Well, the book is fascinating. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed it. It's Skulls and Keys, The Hidden History of Yale Secret Societies. It is published by Pegasus. David Alan Richards, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for sharing with us this morning.
Thank you, Joe, for this opportunity. I thank you, and I hope you have some readers you've interested in the topic. Thanks again.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, Skulls and Keys, The Hidden History of Yale Secret Societies. The book is published by Pegasus. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.